Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling something absolutely fundamental if you're going into pediatric nursing, understanding gastrointestinal conditions in infants and children. We've pulled together, well, a really comprehensive set of resources for you.
Yeah, everything from the big picture overviews to, the specifics of different disorders, even a study guide.
Exactly. And our mission here is to really extract that essential knowledge, the stuff you really need as a foundation to give effective care. Because these little patients, they're vulnerable.
They really are. And GI issues in kids, especially babies, they can escalate so fast. So understanding the conditions, the assessment, the interventions, it's paramount, high stakes.
For sure. So we'll be looking at structural differences, things they might be born with, and also other common GI problems. And we're going to keep coming back to what you as the nurse will actually be
All
doing.
right, the assessments, the hands-on care.
And that central theme, you mentioned it, nutrition, fluids, electrolytes, that balance is just so critical in pediatrics.
Absolutely central.
Okay, so let's start foundational. If you're a nurse and a child comes in with any kind of GI issue, where do you even begin? What are those core assessments?
That's the perfect place to start. Because regardless of the final diagnosis, these initial steps give you so many clues. First, think fuel, nutritional assessment. And
Okay.
it's more than just are they eating, it's how are they eating, breast, formula, solids, tolerating it okay. Any known issues like allergies?
Right.
And critically, is it oral feeding or is there a G-tube involved? Maybe even IV nutrition, parenteral nutrition? You need that baseline.
Makes total sense. You need the normal for that specific child before you spot the abnormal. Okay, what's next after nutrition?
Then you move to the abdominal assessment itself. The classic look, listen, feel, inspect, auscultate, palpate.
Right.
So looking, is the abdomen distended, flat, any weird movements, visible masses? Then listening, bowel sounds, all four quadrants. Are they zipping along, super active, or quiet, or maybe absent? That tells you a ton. And then gentle palpation. Feeling for tenderness, any guarding, any masses you didn't see, organ size maybe. But with kids, gentle and calm is key. You don't want to scare them.
Absolutely. Got to build that trust. Okay, so we've looked, we've listened, we've felt. What about the specifics of, well, what's coming out?
Ah, yes. Stool and vomit. Gold mines of information, truly.
Okay.
For stool, frequency.
Yeah.
How often are they going? What's the color? The consistency? Is there anything weird in there, like those thin ribbon-like stools that can point towards Hirschsprungs?
Okay, that's a subtle one.
It can be. And then the big flashing red light, that red currant jelly stool we see sometimes with intussusception, blood and mucus mixed together, that needs immediate attention.
Wow, okay. Red currant jelly. Got it.
And for newborns, the absolute first question: did they pass meconium in the first 24 hours? If not, that's a major red flag for things like imperfect anus.
Crucial first check. They
Yeah.
vomit.
Similar detective work. Is it projectile? Like really forceful? What's the color? Is it greenish yellow, suggesting bile? How often? And when does it happen? Right after feeding or later? All these details help piece the puzzle together.
Okay, these assessments really paint a picture. Let's shift gears slightly to some structural anomalies kids might be born with. First up, cleft lip and palate. Can you break that down simply?
Sure. So think way back to early pregnancy. The baby's face and mouth are forming, kind of like puzzle pieces coming together. Cleft lip or palate happens when those pieces, the tissues of the lip or the roof of the mouth, just don't fuse completely. So you get a gap or a split.
And it's relatively common, right?
Yeah, surprisingly so. About 1 in 700 births in the U.S. It's the fourth most common birth defect, actually.
How would a nurse typically spot this?
Well, a cleft lip is usually pretty obvious right at birth. Sometimes they even see it on prenatal ultrasound now. A cleft palate, the opening in the roof of the mouth, that might be a bit more hidden. Often the first clue is feeding difficulties. The baby just can't get a good seal, can't create suction.
So, for our nursing students listening, what are the key assessment points right away with a newborn diagnosed with a cleft?
Okay, first, a good visual check. Look at the cleft. Where is it? How big? Just lip, just palate. Both. Then watch them try to feed. Can they latch? Can they suck effectively? Are they getting enough milk? Or are they swallowing a lot of air or having milk come out their nose?
And the parents' reaction.
Oh, absolutely vital. Assess their emotional state. This can be a shock. They might be scared, sad, confused. You need to be sensitive to that.
That's a huge part of pediatric nursing, isn't it? Supporting the family. What are some special considerations there?
Definitely. Acknowledge that they might need time to grieve the perfect baby they imagined. Give them space for those feelings. connecting them with support groups, other families who've been through it, that can be incredibly powerful. And showing them what's possible, explaining the surgical plan, maybe even showing before and after pictures, if appropriate, that can really help foster hope.
So in those first days, what are the nurses' main jobs?
Number one is that emotional support and clear information for the parents. But practically, feeding is a huge focus, making sure that baby gets enough nutrition safely.
Okay.
And then starting that education process about the surgeries that are coming down the road.
Let's really dig into feeding. You mentioned the ESSR method. Can you walk us through that ESSR? What does each letter mean and why is it so important?
Absolutely. It's a lifesaver for these little ones. E is for enlarge. Because of the cleft, they often can't create good suction. So you might need a special nipple with a larger hole, maybe even a slit you make, so milk flows easier with just gentle compression.
Okay, enlarge the nipple hole. Got it. S.
S is for stimulate. You gently stroke the baby's lower lip with the nipple. This encourages them to open wide and start that sucking reflex.
Makes sense.
Next up.
That S is for swallow. This is crucial. Their coordination might be off. You have to give them time to actually swallow the milk. Watch them closely. Are they gagging? Coughing, signs of distress.
Okay, slow down, let them swallow, and R.
R is for rest. Feeding is hard work for these babies. They tire easily. Watch for cues, turning away, breathing faster. Let them take frequent breaks. This prevents aspiration and stops them from burning more calories than they're taking in. You're constantly assessing their breathing during feeds.
That's a great breakdown. Enlarge, stimulate, swallow, rest. Very practical. When do the surgeries usually happen?
Typically, the cleft lip repair happens first, around 3 months old.
Yeah.
There are benchmarks, often called the rule of 10s, like 10 weeks old, 10 pounds, hemoglobin of 10, give or take.
Okay. And the palate?
Cleft palate repair is usually later, often around 1 year old, gives the palate more time to grow.
And post-op? After these surgeries, what are the absolute must-know nursing points, the do's and don'ts?
Priority number one, always, airway. Keep it clear. Positioning is key here. After lip repair, usually back or side, never on the tummy. An infant seat upright can help too.
Right, protect that lip suture line.
Exactly. For palate repair, positioning might vary, maybe side lying to help with drainage. But the big thing is protecting that surgical site. Minimize crying, it puts tension on the stitches.
How do you minimize crying in a baby?
Good pain management is essential. Mm-hmm. Keep them comfortable. You might also see a Logan bow used after lip repair that's a little curved metal bar taped to the cheeks for support.
Okay.
And elbow restraints, no-nos, are usually needed to stop them from putting their fingers in their mouth or messing with the site.
Got it. Airway positioning, protect the site, pain control. Okay, let's switch to another tricky structural issue. Esophageal atresia with brachioesophageal fistula, TAFA. Can you explain that?
Okay, so imagine the esophagus, the food pipe, during development. In esophageal atresia, it doesn't form correctly. It basically stops, ends in a blind pouch, instead of connecting all the way to the stomach.
Just stop.
Right. And then the fistula part, tracheoesophageal fistula, that's an abnormal connection between the esophagus and the trachea, the windpipe. Often these two problems happen together.
So the food pipe is blocked and connected to the airway. That sounds dangerous.
It is. You might have the top part of the esophagus ending blindly and the bottom part actually connected to the trachea.
Yikes. What are the immediate red flags for PEEF in a newborn? What should make a nurse think, uh-oh?
Several big clues. Sometimes a history of polyhydramnios, too much amniotic fluid during pregnancy, because the baby couldn't swallow it effectively in utero.
Okay.
Then right after birth, watch for lots and lots of frothy white mucus just bubbling out of their mouth and nose. And the big ones, the classic three C's, coughing, choking, and cyanosis, especially when they try to feed.
Coughing, choking, cyanosis, the three C's, got it.
Huge red flags. You might also see abdominal distension if air is getting into the stomach through that fistula from the trachea. And if you try to pass an NG tube, it'll just stop, usually around 10, 12 centimeters, won't go further.
That makes sense. So if you suspect TAFE, what do you do immediately? What are the nursing priorities?
Priority one, prevent aspiration. Get that head of the bed elevated 30, 45 degrees. Gravity helps.
Okay.
Baby must be MPO, nothing by mouth. Immediately, you'll need to insert an NG tube, but just into that upper pouch and connect it to low intermittent suction to get those secretions out.
Keep the pouch empty.
Exactly. 4V fluids are crucial for hydration. 4 antibiotics are usually started preventatively. And oxygen, monitoring respiratory status like crazy O2 sats, lung sounds, maybe blood gases.
Okay, moving on to something a bit more common perhaps. Hernias. Inguinal and umbilical, what's the rundown for nursing students?
So a hernia is just when something pokes through a weak spot where it shouldn't. Inguinal hernia, bulge down in the groin. Umbilical hernia, bulge right at belly button.
And you see it more when they cry?
Yep. Crying, straining, coughing, anything that increases abdominal pressure makes the bulge pop out more.
Is treatment different?
Yes. Inguinal hernias usually need surgery because there's a risk the bowel could get trapped. It's called incarceration, and it's an emergency.
Okay.
Umbilical hernias, though, often close up on their own as the baby's muscles get stronger, usually within the first few years.
So nursing assessment is mostly observing.
Observing, documenting the size when it appears, and critically, can you gently push it back in? Is it reducible? For umbilical, you teach parents warning signs. Pain, redness if it suddenly gets hard and won't go back in. That means get help fast. For inguinal, it's usually education about the surgery.
Got it. Next up, anorectal malformation or imperforate anus. Sounds serious.
It is a serious structural defect of the rectum, but the key thing here is that it's usually caught very quickly.
Ow. What's the absolute key nursing assessment?
The number one thing every single nursing student needs to burn into their brain. Did the newborn pass meconium within the first 24 hours?
Back to the meconium check.
Exactly. If there's no stool in that first day, maybe 40 hours max, you must investigate for anorectal malformation. Plus, a visual check of the anus is part of the standard newborn exam anyway.
And treatment. Surgery again.
Always surgical.
Yeah.
It might be a relatively simple anoplasty to create the opening, or it could be more complex, needing a temporary colostomy first, then a bigger repair later.
Nursing considerations.
Nutrition is key, obviously. Preventing infection is huge, especially around any surgical site or stoma. Skin integrity if there's a colostomy. And of course, supporting the family through a stressful diagnosis and surgery.
Okay, let's shift from the structural stuff kids are born with to other GI disorders that pop up. Pyloric stenosis. What's happening there?
Okay, think of the pylorus. It's like a muscular gate valve between the stomach and the small intestine. In pyloric stenosis, that muscle gets way too thick. It's called hyperplasia and hypertrophy, more cells, bigger cells.
So the gate gets stuck.
Essentially, yes. It gets really tight and narrow, so food can't easily get out of the stomach. It usually shows up around 1 to 3 weeks after birth.
And what does that look like? What are the telltale signs nurses should watch for?
The absolute classic sign is projectile vomiting. And I mean projectile. Across the room sometimes.
Wow.
But importantly, it's usually non-bilious vomit. No green or yellow bile. Because the blockage is before where bile enters the system.
Okay. Non-bilious projectile vomiting. What else?
Despite throwing up so much, the baby is often starving. Wants to eat again right away. But because they can't keep much down, they start losing weight, getting dehydrated.
And that palpable olive.
Yes. Sometimes an experienced examiner can actually feel a little olive-shaped lump in the upper abdomen, kind of to the right. That's the thickened pyloric muscle. It's a hallmark sign if you can feel it.
How do they confirm it?
Usually with imaging. Ultrasound is great for seeing that thickened muscle directly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or they might do an upper GI series, a barium swallow. You'd see the barium struggling to get through that narrow channel. They call it the string sign.
And the fix? Surgery again?
Yep. A procedure called a pyloromyotomy. The surgeon just makes a cut in that overgrown muscle, splitting it open to relieve the blockage. Works really well.
Okay, let's talk pre-op and post-op nursing care. What do students need to focus on?
Pre-op. Remember, these parents are probably exhausted and scared. Lots of support needed. The baby needs stabilizing first. IV fluids are critical to fix the dehydration and electrolyte problems from all the vomiting.
Right. Get them stable before surgery.
Exactly. Post-op, it's all about slowly reintroducing feeds. Start small, clear liquids, then gradually increase formula or breast milk volume as they tolerate it, watching for any vomiting.
Any specific handling tips?
Yes. Be gentle. Don't put pressure on that incision. When changing diapers, slide it under. Don't lift the legs way up.
Ah, good tip.
Comfort measures are huge, pacifier, swaddling, cuddles. Feed them upright and get mom and baby back together ASAP. Post-op concerns are basically hydration, electrolytes, and making sure feeding gets back on track.
Okay, moving to intussusception. Sounds painful. What is it?
It is painful. Imagine part of the intestine telescoping into the section right next to it, like pushing the finger of a glove inward.
Oh, wow.
That's intussusception. It's actually the most common reason for intestinal obstruction in kids under 2. This telescoping causes swelling, blocks the bowel, and can cut off blood supply to that part of the intestine.
What triggers it?
Often we don't know the exact cause, But sometimes there's a lead point, like a Meckel's diverticulum, a polyp, maybe a swollen lymph node that kind of gets pulled in first and starts the process.
What are the clinical signs that scream intussusception, the hallmarks?
It often comes on suddenly. You'll see these episodes of severe, crampy abdominal pain, where the baby screams, pulls their knees up to their chest, just inconsolable.
Intermittent pain.
Yes, that's key. Between episodes, they might seem okay, even lethargic. Vomiting is common, maybe some diarrhea early on. But the really classic sign, the one you need to act on immediately, is that red currant jelly stool.
There it is again.
Yep. Stool mixed with blood and mucus. Big warning sign. And sometimes you might feel a sausage-shaped mass in the abdomen during an exam.
How is it treated?
Often, they try a non-surgical approach first, using an enema, either with barium or air. The pressure from the enema can actually push the telescope part back out. It's diagnostic and can be therapeutic.
Cool. And if that doesn't work,
then it's surgery to manually reduce it. If part of the bowel is damaged from lack of blood flow, they might have to remove that section.
Nursing care focus.
Close monitoring of symptoms, frequent abdominal checks, preparing for the enema or surgery, IV fluids, maybe antibiotics, and lots of parent support. And it's scary to see your child in that much pain. Post-op, watching for infection, pain control, fluids.
Okay, malrotation and volvulus. These sound related and serious.
They are. Malrotation is when the intestines don't twist into the right position during development. They're kind of just floating around more loosely than they should be.
Okay.
Volvulus is when the bowel, often because of malrotation, actually twists on itself around its own blood supply.
Cuts off the blood flow.
Exactly. Even a 180-degree twist can do it. Mm-hmm. And that makes volvulus a true surgical emergency. If that tissue dies, you get perforation, peritonitis, potentially fatal.
Urgent. How do they diagnose and treat?
Diagnosis involves imaging. X-rays might show obstruction, but an upper GI series is often key, showing a corkscrew look where the bowel is twisted. Surgery is the only treatment. If the bowel is still alive, they untwist it, detorsion. If it's necrotic, dead, they have to remove that section and resection and sew the healthy ends back together, anastomosis.
Nursing care for volvulus.
Strict NPO, aggressive pain management. 4V fluids are critical, maybe TPN post-op if a lot of bowels was removed, and usually an NG tube to decompress the stomach and bowel. Very close monitoring.
Okay, let's cover appendicitis. Most people have heard of this one. Key things for nursing students to spot.
Right. Inflammation of the appendix. Super common cause of emergency surgery in kids. Big risk is rupture, leading to peritonitis. Treatment is getting the appendix out, usually laparoscopically now.
What's the classic pain pattern?
Typically starts as vague pain around the belly button, kind of achy. Then, over hours, it moves and settles in the right lower quadrant, RLQ. Become sharper.
Always RLQ.
Usually. But remember, maybe 40% of kids have referred pain somewhere else. So keep an open mind. Other signs. Nausea, vomiting, often after the pain starts, low-grade fever.
What about the physical exam?
You're looking for tenderness, especially at McBurney's point in the RLQ. Guarding where they tense up their belly muscles, maybe lying curled up in a fetal position. Rebound tenderness, pain worsening when you quickly release pressure can be a sign, but assess gently.
Diagnostics.
Labs usually show high white blood cells, high C-reactive protein, CRP, signs of inflammation. A CT scan is often used to confirm it. Then prep for surgery.
Okay, we had a lot of acute stuff. What about chronic GI issues students will see? GER versus GR, what's the difference in practice?
Good distinction. GER, gastroesophageal reflux, is just stomach contents coming back up. It's normal in babies. Lots of infants are happy spitters. It usually resolves on its own by 12, 18 months.
Okay, so GER is normal spit up, GERD.
Yeah. GER, the disease part, is when that reflux causes problems, complications, like poor weight gain because they're spitting up so much or refusing feeds, respiratory issues from aspirating small amounts, coughing, wheezing, or esophagitis, inflammation of the esophagus, which hurts.
Do they always vomit with GERD?
No, and that's important. Some babies with GERD don't vomit much but might arch their back, get really irritable doing or after feeds, or refuse to eat. Those can be signs too.
Management.
For simple GER, often just positioning, helps keep the head elevated, hold them upright for 30 minutes after feeding. Smaller, more frequent feeds can help too. For GER with complications, you might need meds to decrease stomach acid on top of those measures.
Constipation seems common, but what should nurses know?
Very common. Key is getting a good history, usual pattern, diet, fluids. Often it's about establishing routines, regular toilet time, especially after meals. Increasing fiber and fluids is basic but important education.
What if that's not enough?
Then you might need short-term help, like an enema or a suppository for a clean-out. For chronic issues, medications like Miralax, polyethylene glycol, are often used to keep stools soft long-term. Bowel retraining can also be part of the plan.
Okay, last one. Hirschsprung's disease. Congenital aganglionic megacolon. Big name. What's the core problem?
Think nerves. In Hirschsprung's, there's a section of the large intestine, usually the end part near the rectum, that's missing specific nerve cells called ganglion cells.
And why are those cells important?
They control the muscle contractions, the peristalsis, that pushes stool along. Without them, that segment of bowel can't relax or squeeze properly. It just sits there, causing a blockage, a functional obstruction.
How does that present?
In newborns, the huge red flag is failure to pass meconium in the first 24, 48 hours. Again.
There it is again.
Yes. They might also have a swollen belly, maybe vomit bile. In older kids who maybe had a milder case missed early, it looks like really severe chronic constipation. They might pass those thin, ribbon-like stools we mentioned earlier and have abdominal distension.
Diagnosis and treatment.
Diagnosis usually involves a barium enema, which can show the narrow affected segment and the dilated bowel above it. But the definitive diagnosis comes from a rectal biopsy showing no ganglion cells. Treatment is surgical.
What kind of surgery?
Often it's a two-step process. First, a temporary colostomy to bypass the bad section and let the bowel rest.
Mm-hmm.
Then later, a pull-through surgery where they remove the aganglionic part and connect the healthy bowel down to the anus.
Nursing interventions.
Pre-op might involve enemas to clean out the bowel. Post-op, if they have a stoma, meticulous skin care and teaching the parents how to manage it is vital. Diet is often low fiber initially, but high calorie, high protein. Absolutely. NO, rectal temperatures, risk of perforation.
No rectal temps. Important safety point.
Crucial. The physician might do manual rectal dilatations later, but that's not a nursing task. Key things for nurses. Prepping for surgery, post-op care, stoma teaching, nutrition, watching for complications like enterocolitis, which is a serious bowel inflammation.
Wow, that was a comprehensive tour of pediatric GI. So for the nursing students listening trying to absorb all this, what are the absolute must-remember takeaways?
Okay, number one, kids, especially babies, are super vulnerable to fluid electrolyte imbalances and nutrition problems.
Yeah.
Always keep that front of mind. Your assessment of these is critical.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, your basic nursing assessments, nutrition history, abdominal exam, looking closely at stool and vomit. These are your best tools. Don't underestimate them. They provide so many clues.
Right.
Number three, know those red flags. No meconium in 24, 48 hours. The three C's of TIF. Red currant jelly stool. These mean act fast.
Okay, red flags.
Number four, understand the basics of pre-op and post-op care for these common surgeries. Know what to expect, what to watch for.
Makes sense.
And finally, number five, never forget the family. Parent education and emotional support are just as important as the physical care you provide. Be their guide, their advocate.
Couldn't agree more. So we've covered a lot. Clefts, TF, hernias, imperforate anus, pyloric stenosis, intussusception, volvulus, appendicitis, GERD, constipation, Hirschsprung's. It's a lot, but hopefully this gives you, our listeners, a really solid foundation.
Definitely a foundation. And as you move forward, always think about how your assessment, your quick recognition, your interventions can truly change the outcome for these kids. It's challenging but incredibly rewarding work. Keep learning, keep questioning.
Well said. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into pediatric GI conditions. We hope this helps you on your journey in pediatric nursing. Keep exploring these topics.